Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. Christmas mysteries have been a seasonal staple of EQMM for many years, and a number of the stories have been written by Steve Hawkinsmith, the New York Times bestselling author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, the Edgar-nominated and critically acclaimed Amling Meyer Brothers series, and other well-received novels, including two series for children. The story you are about to hear belongs to the Amling Meyer Brothers series. It's set in the late 1800s at Christmas out west. Here is Steve Hawkinsmith reading his story, My Christmas Story, from the January-February 2019 issue of EQMM.
Uriah Smythe, Smythe & Associates Publishing Limited, 175 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York. Dear Mr. Smythe, season's greetings to you, Mrs. Smythe, and all the little Smythlings. I hope my stories have helped you put a few extra presents on the tree for them. All my brother and I could afford to exchange last year were pats on the back and an extra helping of beans for our feast, so the money you've sent my way for my stories will make Christmas 1893 a merrier one indeed. Thank you also for sending along the latest Smythe's Frontier Detective, and what a pleasure it is, I must say, to finally have a permanent address it could be sent to. The issue was a real rip-snorter, as usual, and it was a thrill to see me and Old Red, or at least the rather, shall we say, embellished versions of us your illustrators favor, gracing the cover once again. You might want to remind said illustrators, however, that my brother is neither 9 feet tall nor as strapping as a stevedore, quite the opposite, in fact. I appreciate, however, that they have, by way of compensation, made me 12 feet tall and as muscle-bound as Samson before he saw the barber. Our cowboy attire remains as colorful as ever, I see, but at least this month the red and white Stetsons, vests, and boots make us look like a pair of Santa's less heralded helpers, his reindeer wranglers, perhaps? I read your accompanying note about next year's Christmas annual with the utmost interest. I reckoned I couldn't help you out with a story, though, as Old Red and I tend to have the kind of Yuletide that's memorable less for cheer and miracles than deprivation and boredom. We haven't had a family to celebrate with in 6 years, and in that time our Christmases have been spent, one might say endured, pinching our few remaining pennies as fiercely as Ebenezer Scrooge so that we wouldn't starve before the spring roundups. Fond as they might be of my brother and me, your readers probably wouldn't derive much holiday merriment from A Grubline Drifter Christmas or The Miracle of the Abandoned Shack, the miracle being that we found it before we froze to death. Fate, however, stepped in yesterday to supply the very holiday tale you sought, which is why this is shaping up to be a 20-page letter rather than a Courier and Ives card. I don't know if my Christmas story will bring much, in the words of the old song, joy to the world, but, well, you asked for it. As you know, Old Red and I moved to Ogden, Utah last month in order to establish a private investigation firm with our new partners, Colonel C. Kermit Crow and his daughter Diana. It's been slow going. The AA Western Detective Agency has a name and an office and not much else. There are, as yet, no clients, no cases, no work. Colonel Crow has been getting the word out to his old contacts with the government, railroads, express companies, and cattlemen's associations, but so far this has netted us many best wishes for success and not a single contract. The resulting hours of idleness have been as much blessing as burden for me, as I've been able to spend many of them in the company of the lovely Miss Crow. She's provided invaluable assistance as I set up housekeeping for my brother and myself, and I've made the most of her generosity and womanly wisdom. By made the most, I mean I've milked it for all it's worth. I recently dragged Miss Crow to no less than 4 department stores in search of the perfect bed warmer, and at the end of the day I convinced her that we still hadn't seen a decent one and would have to try again the next morning, after sharing breakfast at a restaurant I wanted to try with her, of course. Sometimes I amaze even myself. My brother, meanwhile, descended into such a mood as to make the aforementioned Scrooge look positively jolly. You might think having a warm, snug winter for once would slip a smile beneath his big nose, but no. A permanent frown resided there instead. The first problem was tedium. My mind rebels at stagnation, he'd say, quoting his hero, Sherlock Holmes. Give me work. The second problem was the final problem, or the adventure of the final problem, to be more exact. I'll admit that I'm not always thrilled with the new titles you give my stories. The Black Dove I find evocative and mysterious, for instance, while Range Rider Dick's Smash the Chinatown Terror is, let's just say, less so. but I appreciate that you don't feel the need to stick the adventure of in front of everything, as Dr. Watson's publishers have taken to doing. It seems so obligatory, I wouldn't be surprised were it to extend to everything the doctor puts to paper. Should I receive a Christmas card from the man, I'd expect the inscription to read, "The Adventure of the Season's Greetings." Old Red and I knew that the adventure of the final problem was coming, and the gist of the tale it told, of course, but that didn't lessen the impact on my brother when we got our hands on the December McClures and learned at long last the particulars of Mr. Holmes's passing. When I was done reading out the story, my brother muttered Doc Watson's own words, "the best and wisest man whom I have ever known," before adding a few of his own. So, no more Holmes stories for now. For now? Old Red pointed at the magazine spread out on my lap. We've seen the like before. Just 'cause someone says a feller's dead don't make it so. John Watson ain't just any someone, I said, and Sherlock Holmes, amazing as he might have been, wasn't Jesus Christ. Leave the miracles to the Carrolls, brother. This, I'm sure it will not surprise you to learn, earned me a glare hot enough to cook a Christmas goose. Old Red stomped from the boarding house parlor room in which we'd been sitting, threw on his coat, plopped his white Boss of the Plains upon his head, and left me alone by the fire to stew in regret. Here we were at the holidays, missing more keenly than ever our Mutter and Vater and sisters and brother and all the other dead Amling Myers we'd never see again. And when my brother held out hope that a friend of sorts might somehow return to us from the void that had swallowed our family, I told him to leave the miracles to the Carrolls. I felt unworthy of so much as a lump of coal. If Santa filled my stocking with anything after that, it would be the gift that horses bestow so freely upon the streets of every city. I didn't see Old Red again until the next morning, when he came down for breakfast with the other boarders looking as ireful as when he'd stormed out of the house. Our elderly landlady, Miss Derringer, has already learned not to turn to my brother for mealtime pleasantries, or pleasantries of any kind at any time, and has made more than one caustic comment about his less-than-elegant taste in attire. He doesn't have to slap brands on strays anymore, but he still dresses like he might be asked to any second. So she tends to direct her conversational gambits my way instead, as she did this particular morning. "Usually I'd have a tree in the parlor by now," she boomed at me as I took a seat beside Old Red, who'd positioned himself as far from Miss Derringer as possible. The other boarders gathered round the table, all of them railroad middlemen of one stripe or another, jumped. Miss Derringer leaned toward me expectantly, coffee cup in one withered hand, ear trumpet in the other. "Oh?" I replied. "Why, yes, but Annie tells me there's not a pine, fir, or spruce to be found in town." "Oh?" I said again. I turned to Annie, Miss Derringer's maid, who was bringing a plate of fried potatoes in from the kitchen. "That's right," Annie said. "Every one within a dozen miles has already been..." "Don't mumble, woman," Miss Derringer snapped. Annie stifled a sigh and put the plate on the table. "Every one within a dozen miles has already been chopped down and sculled off," she shouted. "The last ones were selling for $10 each." "Shameful," Miss Derringer proclaimed. Most of us at the table knew to nod in agreement, even as we began piling potatoes and ham and scrambled eggs on our plates. But one of the newer additions to the household shrugged and said, "Supply and demand." "What was that?" Miss Derringer demanded, slamming down her coffee cup and shooting a glare at the heretic. "Speak up, young man." "I said it's simply a matter of supply and demand," replied the young man, who was portly, balding, and well north of 40. Miss Derringer aimed her ear trumpet at him like it was the muzzle of a musket. "And what is that supposed to mean?" "He means it's just business, ma'am," I translated. I threw in, "as he sees it," to keep myself out of the line of fire. Miss Derringer scowled at the young man. If her ear trumpet had been loaded, she would have pulled the trigger. "Christmas trees aren't just business," she said. "They are a tradition, one any good Christian should be able to partake in without being gouged by avaricious opportunists." "Hear, hear," I said as I sawed away at a slice of ham. "Kiss ass," Old Red muttered. "Yes, of course you're right," said the gent who'd set our landlady off, his pudgy face blushing bright red. "Enunciate," Miss Derringer barked at him, banging a little fist on the table with each syllable. "Yes, of course you're right," the man repeated. He attempted to remove himself from the conversation by becoming utterly absorbed in his work, the prodigious over-buttering of a biscuit. Another boarder, an old veteran of the breakfast battles that could erupt if one said the wrong thing, stepped in to give his comrade cover as he made his escape. "Believe me, Miss Derringer, the Union Pacific Railroad agrees with you wholeheartedly," he said. "Arrangements have been made for a Christmas special that will bring dozens of trees to Ogden any day now." "When?" Miss Derringer said. The railroad man cleared his throat. "Any day now," he roared. My brother winced with every word. "Like trying to eat in a damn lumber mill," he sighed. "I heard you, Mr. Turnbull. There's no need to bellow," Miss Derringer blared back at the railroader. "I want to know when any day now is." Mr. Turnbull looked like he profoundly regretted entering the fray. "When the boxcar in Farmington is full," he replied. "Oh-ho! Meaning decent people have to wait for heaven knows how long so that the Union Pacific Railroad can make maximum profit when it finally deigns to let them honor a precious Christian holy day." Miss Derringer returned her glare to the young man, who looked like he wanted to finish his meal beneath the table. "Supply and demand," she spat. "Extortion is what it is." "Fear not, ma'am," I said. "After today, you shall be treeless no longer, and you will not have the Union Pacific or any other capitalist to thank for it." Miss Derringer sat back and widened her eyes. "Oh, and who will I have to thank?" "My brother," I said. Old Red froze, a forkful of fried potato halfway to his opened mouth. "He just volunteered to ride out and find you the most beautiful Christmas tree you've ever seen," I went on. "You supply the axe, I'll supply the pine," he said. My brother put down his fork and swiveled in his seat to scowl at me. "You'll have to forgive me for speaking up on his behalf, ma'am," I said. "You know his voice doesn't carry." Miss Derringer favored Old Red with a small smile. "You are a true gentleman, Mr. Amlingmeyer," she said. She looked him up and down, her smile stiffening. "Despite appearances." After that, we were able to eat in peace, though I knew I'd be paying a price for it. "You big-mouthed, fat-headed idiot," Old Red raged at me in the parlor a little later. The other boarders had dispersed to their railroading, while Miss Derringer was out taking her morning constitutional, which consisted of being pushed around the block by her manservant Claypool while seated in a wicker wheelchair. "Now, now, brother, where's your Christmas spirit?" I said. "I ain't got none, not if it means freezing my ass off trying to find some grumpy old maid a shrub." I shook my head and clucked my tongue. Such an unchristian sentiment. What would Mooter say? At the mention of our mother, Old Red clamped his mouth shut and spun away to face the fireplace. I'd said the wrong thing again, poked at the wound in danger of opening up every year around this time. "Look at it this way," I went on quickly, trying to bury my mistake under a heap of words. "You yourself have been grousing about being bored. My mind rebels at stagnation. Well, here's something useful to do. Plus to give us the chance to try one of the local liveries and get some riding in. And we ought to get the lay of the land hereabouts, don't you think? Ogden's our HQ now. We need to learn what we can about it before the sleuthing work starts coming in. Why, it's all clay for bricks, to put it as Mr. Holmes might. Data, and a foundation for the AA Western Detective Agency." My brother snorted and kept his back to me. But after a moment passed with no sound but the crackling of the fire, he spoke. "So you wasn't just trying to push this tree thing onto me? You'd be coming too?" "Of course I would, and I'll let you in on a little secret, brother. It'll be fun." "Well, I reckon there's no getting out of it," Old Red grumbled. But when he turned toward me again, I do believe there was actually a smile hiding behind his bushy red mustache. An hour later, we were riding out of town, my brother on a rented Pinto, me on a sturdy chestnut Morgan. Behind me, rolled up in a blanket, was an axe brought to us by Miss Derringer's man Claypool. It was a day so perfectly Christmassy it could tempt Dickens to rise from the grave and reach for a pen. The air was crisp and cold, but there was no wind to bite through one's coat, and though the snow was heavy for time, it soon slowed to a lazy dusting of fat, fluffy flakes that drifted down on us like powdered sugar sprinkled over a batch of fresh-baked spice cookies. We ambled south beside the ice-crusted Weber River and the railroad tracks along it, aiming to swing away and leave both behind once we were far enough from the city limits to give us a shot at spotting a suitable Tannenbaum. The trees we passed were beautiful, but, being exclusively box elders, cottonwoods, and big-tooth maples, couldn't have been accommodated indoors by a parlor room any smaller than the Mormon tabernacle. All that remained of whatever young pines or firs that had been in the vicinity was the occasional sad little sawed-off stump jutting up out of the snow. About 2 miles south of Ogden, river and railroad curved to the east, and Old Red and I began searching for a spot to ford and begin our tree-hunting earnest in the flat grassland in the opposite direction. Our competitors had already picked clean the city outskirts and mountain foothills behind us, our logic went, so these two young men were heeding Horace Greeley. We would go west. Now, the Weber is more creek than river around Ogden, but none of us, I'm including the horses, was anxious to get wet on such a day. A little splashing we could handle. A good soaking would turn us into icicles. So as we moseyed over the rocks and frozen mud along the bank, we kept our eyes on the water, looking for broad, flat shallows where the crossing would be easy. Despite the blow of reading of Holmes's death the day before, my brother seemed to be enjoying the ride. He hadn't cut loose with a single sigh, grumble, or snide aside since we'd mounted, so I did the one thing I could to preserve this rare good mood as long as possible. I kept my mouth shut. We were about 40 yards from a particularly sharp bend of the river when old Red suddenly sat up straight in the saddle and turned away from the water. Up ahead, I saw, when I followed his gaze, was a small figure swaddled in what looked like 3 coats, 5 scarves, and 6 knit caps. It was a kid, 7 or 8 years old, toddling along the embankment that bordered the railroad tracks. When he spotted us, he stopped and waved his mittened hands over his head, or as close to over his head as he could get them. He had on so many layers it seemed to take all his might just to lift his arms away from his sides. "Hey," he called to us, "you two got guns?" "Yeah," I shouted back, for old Red and I had left Ogden healed lest we run across wolves or a cougar or such with nothing to fight with but snowballs. "There's some kind of trouble?" The boy swiped an arm at us stiffly. "This way, hurry!" He turned and tottered off the way he'd come. "What do you think that's all about?" I started to ask old Red, but he was already giving his mount a "yah" and charging up the embankment. I dug in my heels and followed. When we reached the top, we saw the boy waddling toward 2 figures on the ground about 100 yards off. They were stretched out flat in the snow, unmoving, between the tracks and the ridge overlooking the river. I reined up and scanned the horizon, looking for a who or what that could have laid 2 people out like that. There was nothing to see but snowy fields and distant cloud-shrouded mountains. Old Red had trotted on ahead, but slowly, his left hand taking his reins while his right slid back toward his holstered .45. I tugged off my gloves and stuffed them into my sheepskin coat before continuing on after him. If there was going to be gunplay, I didn't want to be caught out in the open barely able to jam a finger through the trigger guard. The boy looked at us, waved for us to keep coming, then turned back toward the figures in the snow. "Amon! Saraya! Look!" he shouted. "I found somebody!" He got an answer in 2-part harmony. "Shut up, Gideon!" The voices were high-pitched, but one more so than the other. Those weren't corpses by the tracks. It was a very alive boy and girl around the same age as our new acquaintance, Gideon. They wriggled forward through the snow to peep warily over the edge of the embankment. Whatever had the kids spooked, it seemed, was down by the river. The two on their bellies pushed themselves up and walked over to join their friend. As they brushed the snow from themselves, I could see that their clothes were drab and worn, with mismatched patches here and there. I know poor farm kids when I see them, for I'd spent my first decade plus as one myself. "Hibernate in caves, not on river banks, you blockhead," the boy, a gawky lad of perhaps 12, was saying to Gideon as old Red and I rode up. The girl was a couple years younger, but just as gangly, and looking at them together and hearing how the eldest spoke to the youngest, I instantly knew these three were siblings. I was the baby of the brood myself, you might recall, and though I was doted upon by my sisters, my brother Conrad was even harder on me than old Red. Blockhead would qualify as a treacly term of endearment compared to the things he used to call me. "What's the trouble, kids?" I said. The older boy, Amon, I was guessing, jerked a thumb at the ridgeline behind him. For the first time, I noticed something flat and rectangular, lightly covered with snow there. A sled, a hatchet, was sitting atop it. "We were out looking for a Christmas tree," the boy said, "and we spotted a bear and..." "I spotted it," the girl, Saraya, interjected. Her brother ignored her. "We think it might be dead, but if it's alive, we thought we could shoot it and sell the meat in town." "I thought we could shoot it and sell the meat in town," Saraya said. Amon kept plowing on. "But we don't have a gun, so we sent our little brother to find someone who did." "I sent our little brother," Saraya began. Amon raised his voice so much he was loud enough even for Miss Derringer to hear. "And we'll split the money with you if you help us." Old Red and I both looked nervously at the ridge. If there was a live bear beyond it, it sure was a sound sleeper. I swung down out of my saddle. "Gideon," I said, "would you be so good as to hold our reins for us?" Your average youngster, in my experience, is thrilled to be asked for such small favors by men who, like old Red and myself, look like cowboys. As you know, I've taken to dressing like a gentleman in town, but any time I'm atop a horse again, a 3-piece suit and bowler just seems silly. Gideon was no different than most boys. He waddled forward to take my reins with a grin and an excited, "Yes, sir." My brother dismounted, handed over his reins, then pulled out and cocked his Colt. The cylinder turned smoothly, moving a live round under the hammer. I unholstered my .45 and did as old Red had. The previous winter, we'd nearly been killed by wolves of two varieties, canine and human, because our guns had frozen solid. We weren't going to give a bear the same opportunity now. "That's all you got?" Soraya asked, giving our peacemakers a dubious look. "No rifles?" "Missy," my brother said, "I came out here looking for a tree, not trouble." He stomped off toward the ridge. "Don't worry, bullets are bullets," I told the girl. "These'll do." But I knew she had a point. If a grizzly charges you, you want a buffalo gun to stop him with, not a pea shooter. "Y'all wait here," I told the kids. I resisted the urge to add, "Or better yet, why don't you wait about half a mile that-a-way?" Why spook them? And anyway, they had our horses. If old Red and I ended up an early Christmas dinner for a bear, at least they could ride off before they were made dessert. I turned and followed my brother. Like him, I got to crouching and creeping when I reached the other side of the railroad tracks. We ended up sprawled in the snow beside the sled, just as Eamon and Soraya had been a couple minutes before. We snaked up to the ridge and peeked over the side. The hillside beyond was steep and pocked with boulders and snow-covered brush. "There," old Red whispered, pointing off to the right. About 25 yards from us, halfway down the hill, a big ball of black fur was wedged between two pole-like, white-barked trees. It looked like an animal, all right, but the way it was hunched over, half hidden under fresh snow, made it hard to tell what kind. "You see it?" Gideon called to us. Old Red and I winced. The big ball of fur didn't. "Yes," I said, "we see it." Yet still the fur ball remained motionless. Old Red pushed himself up to his hands and knees and took a long look at the hillside. "There," he whispered. "Snowfall's almost covered it up, but not quite." He pointed at a wide line cutting through the snow. It moved at a diagonal down the slope, starting about 20 yards to our left and ending to our right with the black whatever it was. "A trail," I said, "which means that ain't just an old bearskin coat down there." "Well, it could be. It's just that the bear might still be in it." I sighed. "Any chance we could just wish him happy holidays and get back to looking for the right tree?" "We could move along, sure." Ulred jerked his head back at Eamon, Soraya, and Gideon. "But I don't think they would." I sighed again. "No, I don't guess they would." I looked over at my brother. He was peering down at the dark shape in the snow with a fixed, narrow-eyed intensity that told me it wasn't just the kids who wouldn't leave well enough alone. His curiosity had him hooked, which put me on the hook, too. "All right, then," I said. "Get ready." I slid my Colt into its holster and began gathering up a handful of snow. "Now ain't the time for a snowball fight," old Red said. "I beg to differ," I replied. "Now is precisely the time for a snowball fight." I started packing the snow tight, then gathered up more. My brother nodded brusquely, grasping my plan, then drew a bead on the fur ball. When I had the snow I was holding so round and firm it could have passed for a baseball, I got up on my knees and whipped it at the thing down the hill. It splatted against its dark fur. "Bullseye," I said. "Ain't lost my touch." The mound of hair did not get up to throw a snowball back. It didn't react at all. "Dead?" I said. "Sure looks it," said old Red. He got to his feet and headed down the incline. I drew my .45 again and went with him. Eamon and Soraya crossed the tracks to watch us as we picked our way slowly, carefully down the slope. "Remember," the girl said, "whatever it is, we found it." "Thank you for your concern, young lady," I threw over my shoulder. "If it hops up and tries to eat us, we'll be sure to send half of it your way." "What's happening?" Gideon called out. "I can't see a thing." "Nothing new to see yet," I called back. But that wasn't true for long. As old Red and I drew closer, we got a better view of the shape beneath the snow. It stretched out a few feet to either side of the hairy hump visible from the ridge. All in all, the thing looked to be nearly 6 feet long. A chill went through me that had nothing to do with the frigid air or the snow we were wading through. "Well, merry goddamn Christmas," I said under my breath, for now I assumed I knew what we were approaching. I stopped and holstered my Colt, letting old Red have the honor of unveiling the now obvious. He walked the last few feet without me, knelt beside the body, and pulled it away from the trees it was jammed against. "What the hell?" I cried, instinctively snatching my gun back out again. I'd been expecting the blue-tinged skin and ice-crusted clothes of a frozen corpse. What I saw instead was more shaggy hair and a black, grotesquely grimacing face topped by two long, curling horns. There was a shrill shriek behind us, and I glanced back, thinking I'd see Soraya staring down at the thing's ghoulish features in wide-eyed horror. I was close. It was Eamon, who had his mittens pressed to the sides of his face and his mouth hanging open. Soraya took a couple steps down the hill and leaned to the side to get a better look. "Dang," she said, "that is ugly." "What is it? What is it?" Gideon yelled in the distance. "Come on, guys, tell me." It's a monster," his brother stammered. My initial shock had worn off by now, and I shook my head and reholstered my gun. "No, it ain't no monster," I said. "Not exactly." Soraya took another step down the hill. "What do you mean, not exactly?" "It's a Krampus," Old Red said. He swiveled to give me an astonished look of the "will wonders never cease" variety. "A dead Krampus out in the middle of nowhere." Soraya continued down the hill. "What's a Krampus?" said Eamon, cautiously following his sister. "He's sort of like Santa's helper," I explained, "only he ain't nice. Instead of bringing good children presents, he whips the bad ones or even drags them down to the opposite of heaven." Soraya glared at me. "Don't treat us like we're stupid. We know there's no such thing as Santa." "What did you just say?" Gideon called from up above. "Nothing," Soraya shouted. She stopped a few yards off and went back to glowering at me. Eamon stepped up beside her, but his gaze was glued to the body. "It's a legend, a tradition," I said. "Around Austria and Bavaria and them parts, the night before the feast of St. Nicholas is Krampusnacht. Men dress up like the Krampus and go around town scaring folks. It wasn't anything we ever did. Our people was strictly German Lutheran, but we used to have neighbors who had them a Krampus get-up. They told us all about it." "The Kaufmans," Old Red said wistfully. I nodded. "The Kaufmans. They died in the same flood that had swept away the last of our family." "So that's a costume," Eamon said, his voice suddenly firmer, his back straighter. "Yep," Old Red said, "and I reckon it's time to see who's in it." He reached out for the scowling black mask. "Don't look," I told Eamon and Soraya. Rather than turning away, they came a step closer. My brother pushed the black mask. Beneath it was the pale, gaunt face of a young man around my own age. He had a light peach-fuzz beard and short-cropped blonde hair and piercing blue eyes that gazed up at us vacantly. My brother glanced over his shoulder to see if the kids were still staring at the man. They were. "Recognize him?" he said. They shook their heads. "You know most of the folks hereabouts?" my brother asked. The kids nodded. "So you'd say this here's a stranger," Old Red said, "not from these parts." The kids kept nodding. "What's going on?" Gideon hollered from over the ridge. "Nothing!" Eamon and Soraya shouted together. My brother turned back to the body. He put a hand to the man's cheek for a moment, then took hold of his Krampus get-up, sort of a fur-covered union suit with the mask attached at the top, and gave it a tug. "What are you doing?" Soraya asked. "Trying to figure out how long he's been down here," Old Red said without looking back. "Body's still warmish, costume ain't that stiff, and then there's that trail and the snow that ain't completely covered over yet. That poor fella ain't been here that long. Y'all see anyone else out this way?" Eamon and Soraya went back to shaking their heads. "How about wagon or horse tracks?" The kids shook their heads again. "There's only one way to figure it then," my brother said. He began brushing snow from the front of the man's outfit. "Only this here costume don't make a lick of... Hello?" He pinched something between thumb and forefinger and held it up. It was so small I had to step closer and squint to see what it was. A stubby little sliver of green. "Is that a pine needle?" I said. "Yep," said Old Red. "And what ain't we got around here?" I looked at the trees the body was jammed up against. Aspens. Scattered around them on the hillside were more aspens, as well as some cottonwoods and box elders. If there'd ever been any evergreens around there, they'd already been cut down and hauled off. My brother went back to dusting snow off the man's chest. "There's more needles here," he said. He began working on the man's left shoulder and side. "And a lot more here." Old Red pulled the body forward and began slapping at the back. He didn't have to tell me there were even more pine needles there. I could see them mixed in with the snow. When my brother had cleared off about half the man's back, he came to a sudden stop. "Well, there it is," he said sadly. He went back to brushing away snow, but he worked at it more slowly and gently now. Some of what came away from the body looked icy and red. "Is that blood?" Soraya asked. "Yep," said Old Red. "Our friend here was shot in the back."
"You mean he was murdered?
Eamon said. He swung his gaze to the right, to the left, to the bank across the river, clearly leaping to the logical conclusion. Where there's a murder, there's a murderer. I scanned all around us, too, though I tried to look calm and casual about it. "Just because the man was shot don't mean he was murdered," I said. "Could have been an accident."
"An accident?" Soraya scoffed.
I pointed at the body. "Look at what he's wearing. We thought he was a bear. Maybe someone else did, too. Someone with a rifle."
"I guess that's possible," the girl said. "But why was he out here in that crazy outfit in the first place?"
I shrugged. "Looks warm. Maybe he didn't have a union suit handy." My brother whipped around to gape at me.
"You might be onto something there," he said.
I was joking, brother."
"Oh." Old Red shook his head in disgust. "Should have known." He turned back to the dead man and began fiddling with the front of his costume. Beneath the black fur were buttons that Old Red began undoing. Once he had four or five unfastened, he was able to pull the fursuit aside wide enough to reveal what the man was wearing underneath, a brown sack coat over a frayed and stained hickory shirt. "A working man, judging by the spots on his clothes," my brother said. "Looks like some kind of oil or grease. Whatever the job, it didn't pay much. His coat ain't no thicker than a maple leaf." He undid the top two buttons on the man's shirt. "And no," he said, "he ain't got no union suit on."
"Hey, there's a lady present,"
Eamon protested in a whispery, warbly voice.
"Well, my sister, anyway."
"Oh, hush," Soraya snapped at him. "He's just trying to figure out who the man is and how he got here." Old Red glanced back at the girl and tugged the brim of his Stetson.
"Thank you, miss," he said.
"Well, it seems disrespectful to me," Eamon grumbled. "What is going on down there?"
Gideon called out from the top of the ridge.
"Nothing,"
Soraya and Eamon shouted back again. My brother had already gone back to work, unbuttoning the Krampus outfit enough to reach in and search the man's pockets. He pulled out four things and lined them up on the snow: a tin soldier, a harmonica, and an ornate four-pronged hairpin, all of them shiny new, along with a wadded-up length of rough twine. A fifth and final discovery he turned and tossed to me. It was a book. Even if Old Red could read, he would have had a tough time with this one. It was Infernen Westen, von Karl May, In the Far West by Karl May, in German. I opened it up and found an inscription in German, too. "Für Mutter mit Liebe Ernst," I read out. I offered up a translation for the kids. "For Mother with Love."
"So he stole that book from some lady?" Eamon asked.
Old Red shot the boy an infuriated glare. Hearing the inscription seemed to light a fire inside him, and he pushed himself to his feet and started stomping off up the hill.
"No, and he didn't steal any of that other stuff neither," he said.
Soraya nodded at the body.
"He's Ernst, isn't he?" she said.
Old Red stopped and turned toward her, his expression softening a bit.
"Yes, he is," he said. "And now we know why he was in that outfit, where he was going, and what he was doing when he was killed."
Eamon blinked at him.
"We do?" he said.
"Yeah," said Soraya, "we do."
My brother nodded. "Just look at what he was wearing under that suit, what he had in his pockets, what he didn't have in his pockets, and the slant and size of his trail from the top of the ridge by the tracks down to here. It tells the whole story."
"Including who shot him?" I asked.
Old Red's scowl returned, fiercer than ever.
"Yes, that too."
He turned to Eamon and Soraya again. "Y'all look after Ernst and his things. We'll send someone along for him when we can." He went back to galumping up the hill. I quickly slipped the book back into the dead man's costume, then turned and hurried after my brother.
"Where are you two going?" Soraya said.
"To get our hands on the fellow who left Ernst there," Old Red replied without stopping, "if we ain't missed our chance already."
When we reached the top of the slope, we found little Gideon still holding our horses on the other side of the railroad tracks.
"It's a man, isn't it?" he said.
"Yep," Old Red said.
He took the reins of his horse and swung up into his saddle. I thanked Gideon, then did the same.
"What happened to him?" the boy asked.
"Christmas," my brother said, and he gave his mount a hyah and galloped off.
There was a bit of what we professionals call foul play," I told Gideon.
"But don't worry, the man responsible is miles away, and we're going to go see that he pays for it." I rode off after Old Red, hoping I wasn't a liar. We headed north, backtracking along the same white-frosted fields and distant mountain peaks we'd passed when all we had on our minds was a little tree for our landlady, I'd have had to bellow like old Miss Derringer herself to be heard above the crunch of hoof-crushed snow and the panting of the horses, so I didn't ask my brother where we were going. I figured I'd soaked in enough homesifying to know anyhow. I was right, too. We never strayed from the tracks, following them all the way into town to Union Station, hub of rail travel for half the West. There, the track split and curved and merged again into a great steel jumble beside the big brick station building. Usually, just the sight of all that rail would be enough to give my locomotive-hating brother the collie wobbles, but Old Red was so grimly intent upon the task at hand he didn't blanch, flinch, or tarry. There was a Union Pacific train parked behind the depot, 5 passenger cars and 1 freight car, and he pointed at it and simply said, "There." We left our mounts at the hitching posts out front and hurried in, bound for the platform out back. I swung my head this way and that as we rushed through the cavernous station building, searching for a high-peaked blue bowler and matching coat and trousers, the uniform of the Ogden City Police Department. I could have darted up to any ticket window and asked for the railroad police, of course, but I didn't bother. We needed a lawman, not some bull with a tin badge. I saw passengers, porters, and clerks, but no law. We'd have to proceed without it. We burst back out into the snowy cold and found the train right before us. The passenger cars were mostly empty, with but a smattering of stragglers still making their way from the platform. That made it easy to spot the little group gathered by the boxcar attached to the back of the train. 4 men stood there, the conductor, 2 gentlemen in dark suits and overcoats, and, a little way off, a younger fella in a flat cap and scarf fiddling with a camera on a tripod. The door on the freight car was open just wide enough to reveal a burly, bearded man peeking out of the shadows. The photographer seemed to be pointing the camera at him. The conductor turned to eye us as we hurried up, but the other men didn't notice. "So we'll have the door open all the way with Mr. Turner in the center," said the photographer, lifting up a flash pan in his left hand. "Mr. Holm, Mr. Eichelberger, you'll be looking up at him." "I think I should be shaking Mr. Holm's hand," said the slimmer of the suited gents, Eichelberger, presumably, "like so." He turned to the other businessman type, took his right hand in his own, and smiled stiffly. "Sure, the old grippin' grin," the photographer said. "It's a classic." The conductor, meanwhile, had peeled away to intercept me and my brother. "Can I help you?" he said quietly. "You on this when it came to town?" Old Red said, jerking his thumb at the train. "I was," the conductor replied, voice still low. He glanced back nervously to see if the other men were watching. They weren't. "A railroad detective aboard with you?" my brother asked. That finally got the other fellow's attention. They all looked our way. Even the big bearded man in the boxcar leaned out to peer at us, and I noticed for the first time that he was wearing a scarlet cloak and stocking cap. "Yes," said the conductor, still speaking whisper soft. He nodded back toward the fellow in red. "Mr. Turner, is there a problem?" "I'm afraid so," said Old Red, making no effort to quiet himself at all. "Some kids and us, we found a man's body a couple miles outside town. He'd been shot in the back, and I believe the deed was done on this train." The conductor jerked up so straight it was a wonder his little flat-topped hat didn't fly off like a blackbird taking wing. "What?" he blurted out. The men in suits, however, weren't having any of it. "They're drunk," said Holm, the tubbier of the two, sneering at our rough cowboy clothes. Eichelberger turned to the photographer. "Sorry about this, Bellinger," he said. "Just carry on." The young man behind the camera nodded, but immediately went back to watching me and my brother with a little smirk on his face. "Don't be ridiculous," the conductor was telling us. "I think I'd know if a passenger on my train had been shot." "If they was in a passenger car, sure," Old Red said, "but this one wasn't." "It's just a prank," Holm assured the older gentleman. "The rougher elements of the West find it amusing to guy respectable people." The conductor took a small step to the side, placing himself even more directly between us and the train. "If you really found a body outside city limits, that's a county matter," he said, lowering his voice again. "Go tell your story at the sheriff's office." Old Red shook his head. "Any evidence'll be gone by then. Now, if you'd just let me take a look in that car there." He started to step around the conductor. "This has gone on long enough," Holm barked at the man standing in the freight car. "Remove them." The railroad dick looked stricken, yet he nodded and hopped down onto the platform. The photographer and conductor had called him Mr. Turner, but any passing child would have had a different name for him. Santa Claus. The man was done up like Saint Nick all the way from his black buckled boots to the tip of his red stocking cap.
He was a bit too young for his beard to have gone snowy white, but he already had the belly that would shake like jelly when he laughed, only he wasn't laughing. "All right, Tex," he snarled as he lumbered toward us, "move along." And move old Red did, not skedaddling, but stepping to his left to better see through the freight car doorway the man was no longer blocking. "Hello," he said, "and there we are." I stepped to the left, too. Inside the boxcar I now saw were bound green and brown shapes stacked nearly to the ceiling. Pine trees, dozens of them. The Christmas special we'd heard about at breakfast had arrived. There were pine needles on that man, we found, and not a pine tree for miles, Old Red said. The body had been dumped down an embankment by the railroad tracks, but it didn't roll straight downhill. Its trail through the snow shows it came down at a slant, 'cause it had, whatchamacallit? Momentum, I said. Momentum, my brother repeated firmly, without looking over at me. He had the full attention of the businessman and the photographer now, and he kept his eyes on them so as not to lose it. It was already moving, fast, when it hit the top of the hill, and that snow trail makes the direction plain, south to north, toward Ogden. The big, seething Santa had stopped, stunned, when Old Red started in about the pine needles, but now he recovered his wits and began stalking toward us again. "That's enough," he snapped. "Joke's over." My brother began walking backwards without looking away from his audience. He had toys and a book inscribed for his mother on him, he said quickly, but no ticket. He was coming home for Christmas the hard way, freight hopping. I was walking backwards now as well, for if I hadn't, Turner would have already overtaken me. I was hoping the men in suits would call him off, but instead Eichelberger just turned to his stout friend and said, shall we try a shot without Santa Claus? If there's proof, brother, Old Red said, it'll be in that boxcar. Right, I sighed, knowing what he was really saying. I stopped, backing away. Santa Claus kept coming, another 4 steps, in fact, and he'd be treading on my toes. Did you get my letter? I asked him. He'd been aiming his glower at my brother, but now he shifted it my way with a, huh? I stepped forward and delivered a right to Santa's gut, followed by a left to his bearded chin. The first blow started to double him up, and the second jerked him straight up again. Sorry, I said as he went stutter-stepping backwards, stunned. Ain't no way you're bringing me a pony after this, is there? My brother had already darted off, headed for Holm and Eichelberger. They both shrank back and put their hands up and spluttered out things along the lines of, "Now, wait just a minute." Old Red shot between them, leapt up into the boxcar, and disappeared. Turner Claus blinked his eyes twice and cleared his head with a shake. "You naughty, naughty boy," he said to me. Actually, he gave me a label quite unfit for a Christmas story, or indeed any publication remaining on the right side of our nation's obscenity laws. He brought up his right hand and pressed it against his left breast, as if reaching for something there. His fingers just clutched at the fabric of his suit, and he looked down in surprise. In the heat of the moment, he'd forgotten he was dressed as Santa. "Shoot," he spat. That's not quite what he really said, either. He bunched up his fists and started toward me, then seemed to notice for the first time that I was now alone. He whipped around, saw the businessman and the conductor and the cameraman looking back and forth between us and the boxcar door, and realized where Old Red had gone. "Get him out of there," he roared. Before anyone could move, not that anyone seemed inclined to, 2 syllables echoed out of the darkness of the car. "Hello?" I turned to Bellinger, the photographer. "You might want to get that camera ready." Holm jabbed a finger at the man. "Don't you dare," he said. My brother reappeared at the boxcar door, a gray flannel blanket in his hand. "This was over the blood," he said. "Wasn't no way to mop it up because the car's so cold. It's froze solid to the floorboards. You'd have to hope no one noticed before you could get rid of it with hot water. Right, Turner?" "Codswallop," said Holm. "Balderdash," said Eichelberger. But the conductor turned to Turner, looking aghast. "What have you done?" he said. Turner's mouth fell open, but no words emerged, so Old Red answered for him. "Shot a man in the back. The poor feller chose the wrong car to hide in. So cold he had to put on a costume he was taking home with him just to keep from freezing. Is that what got him killed, Turner? The first suit he had on?" "First suit," said Eichelberger. Holm put one hand to his head while stretching out the other as if searching for something solid to prop himself up with. "He was dressed like a bear," Turner blurted at them. "I came back to check on the trees, and this big hairy thing attacked me, so I defended myself. It's not my fault." Old Red shook his head sadly. "Shot a man in the back," I said. "He wasn't attacking you. He was hiding or trying to get away, but you panicked and shot him anyway, which is why you decided, once you realized what you'd done, to toss the body. Maybe that's what you were planning for one of these here trees the UP was bringing in. Wasn't no need to check on them. You knew a good spot to leave one behind for yourself. A place where the tracks run up so close to a ridge you could dump something big unnoticed. But that's guesswork. Sticking to the facts, you killed an unarmed man, and even with you being a railroad dick and him riding the rails, you'd have to answer to the law. On top of which, you'd be spoiling your employer's Christmas stunt. Your job was on the line, maybe even your freedom, so you threw that poor young man out like trash and carried on like nothing happened. And if some kids out looking for a tree of their own hadn't come along at just the wrong time, you'd have gotten away with it, too. Turner, Holm, Eichelberger, the conductor, the photographer, all of them just stood there, gawping at my brother. They weren't alone by this time, either. The commotion by the boxcar had been noticed by the stray passengers and porters still out on the platform. More than a dozen people had heard my brother's speech, and now they were glaring at Turner and the railroad men, all of them obviously wondering the same thing. You gonna let him get away with that? Eichelberger cleared his throat. Well, these are serious accusations, sir, very serious, he said. I think it would be best if this conversation took place in private. Then, thoom! There was a whoosh and a burst of harsh white light, and a little cloud of gray smoke went billowing up over the platform. Bellinger had finally set off his flash powder and taken his photograph. Now, there's a reason you never saw that picture in any papers, though the fact that it existed surely worked in our favor. Bellinger was from the Ogden Examiner, the Union Pacific's primary mouthpiece in these parts. They were planning a cute little item about the UP playing Santa for the town by bringing in Christmas trees. The fact that this could now be replaced by a new, not-so-cute item, with photo and witnesses, no doubt made Eichelberger and Holm all the more receptive to what Old Red and I had to say. Which is why, once Turner had been sent off to the sheriff's office to turn himself in, after changing out of the red suit, of course, we were able to get down to brass tacks. The dead man's family was to be located and compensated, and you can bet I double-checked on that later. I don't believe in Santa Claus or a railroad doing the right thing out of the goodness of its heart, so I can confirm that the Mueller clan of Willard, Utah has received both an apology and a sizable check from the Union Pacific. As for me and Old Red, we didn't ask for much. We each rode away from the station with a little pine tree strapped down behind us. One we left with Amon, Soraya, and Gideon when we went back out to make sure the sheriff's deputies were doing their jobs. The other returned with us to Miss Derringer's boarding house. Delightful, our landlady declared as Annie and Claypool set it up in the parlor. She then squinted and leaned so far forward I worried she was about to topple over like a fell tree herself. A bit on the scrawny side, though, isn't it? That's why my brother picked it out to bring home, I replied, slapping a hand on Old Red's slight shoulder. Reminded him of himself. My brother shrugged away my hand and stalked off to avail himself of the eggnog Annie had made for the occasion. If you're wondering about that photograph young Bellinger took, recall that Ogden is a company town, and the Examiner a town paper. The next day, Holm and Eichelberger were indeed featured on page one, but it was in a different picture, one that showed a new Santa Claus presenting the Union Pacific men with a freight car full of much-needed trees. This Santa didn't fill out his suit nearly so well as the first, and behind his fake white beard I spied the unhappy face of a man who wished to be off checking his watch and shouting, "All aboard!" Of course, New York City is a long way from Ogden, and Smythe & Associates Publishing Limited isn't beholden to any railroad. Old Red and I didn't make any promises about keeping the story to ourselves, so if you want it for that Christmas special, Mr. Smythe, it's yours. I would only ask that you split payment three ways, sending the proceeds to the addresses below. I know the money won't reach everyone until well into the new year, but for some, a little late Christmas cheer will be far better than none. Ingrid Mueller, 57 Tom's Road, Willard, Utah. Amon, Soraya, and Gideon Oaks, Riverdale Road, Weber County, Utah. And yours truly, Otto Amlingmeyer, 508 16th Street, Ogden, Utah, December 21st, 1893.
My Christmas Story is copyrighted by Steve Hackett Smith. Music for the podcast Christmas Snowfall was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.ellerycreammysterymagazine.com. Happy holidays to all.